Welcome to the Pete Ball Putt Podcast here on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. I'm your host today, Pete Ball, joined by Chad Young. Chad, we've had a lot of baseball. We had a heck of a debut. There's no shortage of stuff to talk about, but before we get into it, let's do some numbers. This is episode 136, and I don't know, Chad, I'm looking, and like the top two guys are guys who didn't wear 36 that long. It looks like there's one obvious answer, but I never saw him pitch, so I'm going to defer to you here.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the guys who wore it most at the top are Robin Roberts and Gaylord Perry. Roberts was way before our time. Theoretically, I was alive for the end of Gaylord Perry's career, but not in any meaningful context. So I have no recollection of seeing him pitch. And so you start going down this list by war, and it's like, I mean, David Wells wore it for 8 years at some point. Tom Gordon wore it for 16 years. Like I don't know. There's not a lot of guys that are sort of integral to my baseball watching life that
I've got
are
one
associated
for you
with this number. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm looking for guys who have fantasy relevance during the time I've played fantasy baseball. And Joe Nathan wore it for 16 seasons across the Giants, the Twins, yeah, the Rangers, the Tigers, and the Cubs. So twice in your division, potentially he's not going to make the Hall of Fame, is he? I mean, he was a hell of a closer around forever, but it's so hard for those guys to make it. But in terms of fantasy relevance, he'd get my vote.
Yeah, I mean, for fantasy relevance, for sure, and for sort of relevance to my baseball life, yeah, I think that's totally reasonable. Hall of Fame for him is an interesting question. I have such a hard time with relievers and the Hall of Fame, mm-hmm, because so often relievers are guys who tried to start and couldn't make it as starters.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time with being like, yeah, this guy's a Hall of Famer, but if he had been better, he wouldn't be. And it's like, that's weird. That doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. And I don't think there's a super analogous situation in any other, like someone else was like, well, relievers are like punters. I'm like, no, because punters aren't failed wide receivers. Nobody's like, I'm going to go be a wide receiver. Oh, that didn't work out. I guess I'll punt. Like, it's a totally unrelated skill. And so I can't really think of another scenario where, like, I have no issue with Mariano Rivera being in the Hall of Fame, but if he was a 20% better pitcher than he was, he wouldn't even gotten a vote. He'd get zero votes. He just was bad enough to be good enough.
Oh, careful. You're going to have a lot of people coming after you now.
But it's true, right? I mean, it's not, this isn't like he, I don't know, I could go after the Boston fan base too. Like, Papelbon, I don't think is a Hall of Famer, but like one of the best closers of his generation, but like he's a closer because they weren't sure he was ready to start and he just sort of stuck in the bullpen.
Yeah, no, I totally see the point. I think in Mo's case, he obviously gets an exception because of all the playoff success and that, but I'm overall with you. I think you need to be a real standout. Joe Nathan is 10th all time in saves, which super impressive, great historic career. I don't know if that gets you in the Hall of Fame though. So, but we'll give him an episode.
I agree.
You know, this is
sure
put this on his Wikipedia page. So
that's right.
Way to go, Joe. So Chad and I were kicking around ideas on what to do for this week's episode. And you know, the two things people want to talk about are like, you know, the hot starts and are they going to stick, and then the slow starts and are those going to stick? And so we're going to compare players who, in one case, a guy might be someone who was drafted pretty high and had really high expectations and has been kind of bad so far. And the guy we're going to compare him to is going to be someone who is maybe drafted a lot lower, or a lot later, I should say, than that other player, but has performed arguably better or a lot better in some cases. And we're going to decide who do we like more rest of season and who do we like more in our keeper leagues? Because remember, those could be two different responses, especially with, you know, cost considered and everything else. So, Chad, does all that kind of make sense to you?
That sounds good.
All right. So let's jump in with the first one. We're going to kind of go by position. And this player, although I love him, is absolutely killing me in one of my leagues. And that's Xander Bogaerts. Bogaerts has been brutal. I don't want to steal too much thunder from Chad's analysis, but he's posting his worst strikeout rate of his career, his worst barrel rate since 2017 when he was abysmal, his worst expected slugging since 2017, his worst exit velocity of his career. Xander Bogaerts has been bad. He was signed to that long-term contract to be a shortstop for like 11 years for the Padres. Nobody really knew what they were thinking. He's already moved to second base, so that wasn't working. Where he's fielding well, and I'm not worried about play time so much with Bogaerts, I just don't know if it's going to turn around. And I looked back, Chad, I was like, maybe this is just a slow start thing for him and he was bad last April. Nope. Last April, he hit 6 home runs. He was really good. He was bad in May, but he hit 6 homers in April. So it's not a slow start thing. And I wanted to compare him to Ezekiel Tovar because according to Player Raiders, Tovar has been better. Tovar is not exactly, you know, hitting the cover off the ball, but Bogaerts has been so bad that Tovar has been better. I know you're a fan of Tovar. He does have a 32% strikeout rate, which isn't great, but otherwise pretty much across the board, he looks as good or better than Xander Bogaerts. So Chad, rest of season and then long-term, who do we like more? And long-term's tough. There's a huge age difference between these two players, but Xander Bogaerts versus Tovar.
So doesn't that make long-term easy because there's a huge age difference between these players?
I meant tough in that, like, it's tough for Bogaerts to win that one, I guess.
Yeah. No, I think long-term, this is a no-brainer. We'll get into the analysis of what's going on right now, but I think if you're in a keeper league, you have a choice between these two guys. Like, Tovar's still just 22. I think one of the things So Tovar, I think, like, it's easy to say, like, okay, you know, he had a full season last year. He came up briefly in 2022. Like, he's quote unquote been around for a couple of years now, and hasn't really broken out in any significant way. But like, it's hard to be successful as a 20, 21 year old, which is what he was doing. And he plays very good defense. And so he's going to stick in the lineup. And so I think he's going to have time to get things figured out. And I think that's what it comes down to with him. I mean, if you look at his track record, he didn't really run super high strikeout rates until he got to the majors. He has shown decent power in the past, not like elite power, but decent power. He steals bases. He does a little bit of everything. And I think the overall offensive profile is going to improve just as he develops. He's still really young and there's still time for him to get a lot better. And so I think long-term, this is actually a relatively easy choice for me. And so then the question in a keeper league comes down to like, or an auto new league, something like that, is like, how close are they right now? Like, how much am I willing to add, let's say, to Tovar? Or am I willing to add to Tovar to get Bogaerts because Bogaerts can help me today? And I'm not sure they're very far apart. I mean, obviously, like, Tovar has been much better so far this year because Bogaerts has just been awful. But Bogaerts, I mean, he's sort of a weird guy because his offensive value has often come from just getting on base rather than, he doesn't hit a ton of home runs, he doesn't steal a ton of bases, he doesn't do a ton of all that other stuff. He's not really doing that right now. And so he's sort of a weird guy where his ceiling isn't that high. And that makes me want to go with the younger guy anyways, when they're performing pretty close to each other. And they are, I mean, they're unfortunately, like, you know, as much as Tovar has been better than Bogaerts, like, his ex-WOBA is 271 versus Bogaerts of 292. So part of this right now is Tovar is outperforming his batted ball data. Bogaerts is underperforming his batted ball data. And we're not actually seeing the kind of progress I would have hoped for early season from Tovar, right? Like, his strikeout rate is up. His walk rate really hasn't improved. His chase rate is up. His swing rate is up. His swinging strike rate is way up. Like, we're not seeing the sort of incremental improvements you'd like to see from a 22-year-old like Tovar that would make you feel like, that would make this easy. That would make this a very clear, like, oh, his trajectory is there. You can see where he's headed. Tovar is going to be a really solid player and Bogaerts is on his way out. And that's just sort of the way to do it. And so that's the only thing that gives me pause. I think the other advantage that Tovar has is he plays half his games in course. And so like he has a 250 wOBA on the road, a 366 at home. If he doesn't develop, if he just is sort of what he is, you can just play him in half of his games and get value out of Ezekiel Tovar. And you can't do that with Bogaerts right now. There's no obvious way to sort of use him and be like, oh yeah, he's struggling here. Like, but in this other context, he's just been bad. Like he hasn't been good. And so if I think I'm looking at this and saying like, even short term, I can use Tovar half the time. And I feel pretty good about using him that half the time. And Bogaerts, I really can't use it all right now. And given their ages, I expect very different trajectories going forward. I'd rather take a shot at Tovar.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think long term, I too would rather have Ezekiel Tovar. I'm holding out minimal. I'm not expecting last year's numbers from Xander Bogaerts, because if you look at last year, like, he did pretty well. 19 homers, 19 steals, 285 average is well above league average. And he did score 83 runs in that lineup that like oddly disappointed last year. So couldn't he maybe score more this year? I'm concerned about the steps back that he's taken so far. So I don't think it's fair to expect you're going to get his 2023 production. But I will point out to folks, his second half in 2023, after hitting 250 in the first half, he hit 320 in the second half. So I know I mentioned in April he was much better last year, but overall, if we did first half, second half, he did perform much better in the second half. So if you're stuck with Bogaerts like I am, maybe there's hope. But Tovar at 22 years old, like you said, power and speed playing at Coors. Rest of season, I'm still taking Bogaerts long term. You're right. I don't think that one's close. I'd much rather have Tovar. Chad, I think this next one is going to ruffle some feathers. this one is a little aggressive because it's one player who going into the season, a lot of people loved. Going into pretty much every season, a lot of people love this guy. That's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Lord knows I have him everywhere. I made the mistake of taking him over some pretty good players in quite a few leagues. And so far, he's just continued to basically do what he's been doing for a while now. I don't think what we're seeing is going to be too much different from last year. He's a guy who doesn't strike out a lot, although he is posting a career high strikeout rate right now. He walks a lot, hits the ball into the ground, hits the ball really hard, does Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And I wanted to compare him to Alec Bohm, who people may be like sick of Alec Bohm, but he's only 27. So he's arguably like in the middle of his prime, entering his prime. And his Statcast numbers this year are crazy. You want to talk about somebody who doesn't strike out. Alec Bohm only struck out 15.4% of the time last year. He's at 15.6 this year. That is very, very good. He's increased the walk rate almost 3 percentage points. And, I mean, the Statcast page is tomato red, man. I mean, everything is lit up positively for him. He's really cut down on the ground ball since those first two seasons where he's starting to lift the ball a lot more and more. That's led him to only 4 home runs so far that season, but I'm pretty sure that matches Vlad, and he's hitting 343. So Vlad obviously went really high in drafts. Alec Bohm wasn't like forgotten about in drafts. He didn't go nearly as close to Vlad. As a matter of fact, Alec Bohm's ADP was around 158, whereas Vlad was like a second round or third round pick in most cases. He was at 30.4 on the ADP. So rest of season and going forward, am I too crazy to compare these two, or is it maybe closer than people want to believe it is?
Boy, this is really a question of what you think of Vlad, right? I mean, that's what this comes down to, is like, you know, you still look back and Vlad still like that 2021 season, like it really happened. He really did have a season with a 300, 400, 600 triple slash with 48 home runs. Like that's a real thing that he really did. And he was 22 at the time. And so I think part of the challenge with Vlad Guerrero Jr. is, you know, he came up so young and he was so good at some of the things that are hard for young players. He wasn't striking out. He was drawing walks. He was putting the ball in play. And it was just like, we know he's strong. So it's just a matter of time until the power comes. And then he did it at age 22. Like we were just talking about Tovar still being young at 22. That was Vlad's big season. He was 22. And I think it was really easy after that year to be like, this guy is going to dominate for a decade plus. And then he just sort of went back to doing what he was doing before that season, like that season never happened. And, you know, people talk about the fly balls, but like, he had a 44.8% ground ball rate in that crazy season. It's 46.2 this year. Like, it's not like he, that's not the issue right now. It's just not working for him. His hard hit rate, though, this is where the stuff gets better. His hard hit rate is higher than it was in that 2021 season. It'd be a career high. His barrel rate is not quite as high as it was that year. It was 15.1% that year. It's 12.7% this year. That would be the second best barrel rate of his career. He has the second highest average exit velocity of his career. And his ex-WOBA is up at 369, which is well above the 339 WOBA he's actually posted so far this year. So I think at some level, we are seeing Vlad do some of the stuff we needed to see him do. He's hitting the ball harder. He's hitting the ball in the air a bit more. Although actually, I think I cited wrong before when I said his strike, his ground ball rate was 46.2. It was 46.2% last year. It is 49.2% this year. So maybe he's not hitting the ball in the air as much as he should, but he is hitting the ball hard. He's doing the things we expect to see him do, and stuff's just sort of not falling in for him right now. Mostly that's a home run per fly ball rate thing, I think. Because his BAPIP looks fine. It's 325. He's got a 22% line drive rate. So like a high BAPIP is not crazy. But for Vlad right now, it does seem like that 11.8% home run per fly ball rate, which is a career low, is the thing that's holding him back. And it doesn't appear to be a batted ball quality issue. Right? He's hitting the ball as hard as ever. There's really no reason he should have that low a home run per fly ball rate. That should improve going forward. But having said all that, I think we probably need to pretty seriously temper our expectations of what Vlad Guerrero Jr. is. Because I think he's just not the MVP candidate he looked like as a 22-year-old, at least on a regular basis. That is a thing he did. It is a thing he could do again. It could happen at any time. But I don't think we can just count on him to do that. Like, coming out of 2021, I would have said he's going to do that year in, year out, or close to that. Coming out of 2022, I would have said he's going to bounce back and be close to that 2021 year in, year out. He's still just 23 years old. He's still just 25 years old. Like, it's not like he's old yet. But we now have a longer track record, right? I mean, even since that breakout season, right? Even if you only look at what's happened since that 2021 season, we have over 1,400 plate appearances since then. And so I think we sort of have to just look at Vlad, and Vlad is sort of what we think he is, which gets us over to Alec Bohm. And I mean, I have Alec Bohm on a couple teams. I'm very happy I have Alec Bohm on a couple teams. I think it is worth noting that his 410 WOBA, as great as it is, his ex-WOBA is 368. I just told you that Vlad's ex-WOBA is 369. And this is that's an oversimplification, but no, I am not willing to take Alec Bohm over Vlad. I think Vlad is safer. I think the floor is higher. Right. I mean, as good as Bohm's been this year, his WOBA's last 2 years are 310, 329. And like, he was solid last year. He was a good fantasy player for me last year, especially in auto new leagues. He was great down the stretch, and he helped carry my League 13 team that I co-managed with Niv. Like, he helped carry us to a championship. He was excellent down the stretch. I don't think it is a fair fight to put him up against Vlad, because I just don't think he's at that level where you can I expect Vlad to be better. Like their expected outcomes are better. Vlad has the higher floor and Vlad has the higher ceiling. And so I get that one of them has been better by a lot so far this year. Like I get how good Bohm has been. I'm just not willing to assume it's going to be like that for him going forward. Having said that, like Bohm has a career high walk rate. He is brought, you know, his strikeout rate was a little bit lower last year, but it's basically over the last year plus, he's had a career low strikeout rate. He is chasing less than ever this year. He has a 5.5% swinging strike rate this year. That is, you know, among the top 10 to 15 best swing strike rates in baseball. Like, he is putting the ball in play. He's putting the ball in play with pretty high quality contact, as you noted from his Statcast page. He also has a 391 BABIP. Like, that's not going to continue. Things are going to start to fall back down to earth. Even with all this great contact, his barrel rate is still way lower than Vlad's. It's 7.6%. His hard hit rate is still way lower. He doesn't have the same max exit velocity, high-end power potential. Like, it's just, you know, he has a 10.8% home run per fly ball rate. I think I said Vlad's was around 11. Vlad's at 11.8. And I expect that to go up for Vlad. I think this is just sort of who Bohm is. Like, that's just from a power perspective. And so at the end of the day, I'm still going to take Vlad. I think the one maybe caveat to that is Bohm is a really good batting average play. Vlad has been at times in the past too. I don't know. I'm taking Vlad. I think that's where it goes, both short-term and long-term.
Yep, so I was going to say the same thing. I'm taking Vlad both short and long-term. I do think Bohm's floor is higher than it was before. I look at his skill set and I think, like, this guy is just going to give us a pretty decent batting average. The expected, like, the BABIP and everything else is one thing, but the expected batting average is 303, which is absurdly high for an expected batting average. So I do think Bohm does have a little bit of a safe floor, but to your point, the potential range of outcomes for Vlad is just higher on both ends. And I think Alec Bohm's skill set at its best is easier to replace than Vlad's skill set at its best. Like, if Vlad is clicking on all cylinders, like we have actually seen in the past, which I think is an important point that you made, you can't replace that. Whereas a corner infielder who can maybe hit for some average in addition to middling power, like, we can find that. You know, we can take care of that on our rosters. So I'm going Vlad, both short and long term. But the fact that it's even a conversation, I do want to validate those managers that drafted Vlad so high. Like, we need more. We need more. And if he posts another season similar to last year, I mean, when is he going in drafts? Like, sixth round, seventh round? Like, it's just not the trajectory we expected for this dude's career. So hopefully those expected numbers and the extreme exit velocities and stuff start actually giving us results. And I think the home run per fly ball rate is an apt place to look for that. We should have better results on the way. We're going to take a look at some starting pitchers before we take a break. Shoto Imanaga or Kevin Gausman. So Gausman had a weird outing yesterday. The Twins killed me this week. I have Logan Gilbert and I have Kevin Gausman in multiple spots. And they both got shelled by the Twins out of nowhere. The Twins are on fire. I don't know what's going on in Minnesota. Because you look at that lineup, it's like, eh. But they're killing aces, man. Gausman's velocity, he was throwing like 99, 98 yesterday. I mean, he was way up there in velocity, which is the first thing I looked at because I saw the stat line. I'm like, oh no, Gausman's got to be hurt. He just got lit up. And so he's been a little inconsistent to start the season. He had a weird start to the year, folks remember. I can't remember if he actually started on the IL or if he was just delayed. I think he started on the IL. So maybe he's still getting warmed up and whatnot, but it's time to start really thinking about Shoto Imanaga. I know that our president here at Pitcher List, Nick Pollock, was really in on Shota Imanaga. I was hoping the Red Sox would get him. It seemed like nobody wanted him. And he has done nothing but pitch amazingly for the Cubs. I mean, at this point, forget about rookie of the year. Like, this guy is looking at a potential Cy Young Award, just zapping all of the hype from Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who also came over this year and is pitching for the Dodgers. So I mean, it's a crazy question to ask because we're only a month and a half in, and it takes a while for pitchers to kind of stabilize here, especially in the case of Gausman, who's been so good for so long and had that weird start to the year. But, Chad, are you ready to take Shota Imanaga rest of season over Kevin Gausman, and what about long-term?
Yeah, this is a hard one for me. I want to start just by noting that, like, Imanaga right now has a 23.8% strikeout minus walk rate, right? So 26.9% strikeout rate, 3.1% walk rate. Boy, 31% would be bad. 3.1% walk rate. So 23.8 strikeout minus walk rate. Gausman was 23.9 on that last year. Like, Imanaga is basically pitching the way we expected Gausman to pitch. So it's an apt comparison, I think. So let's talk about Gausman first. He had a weird start to the season, as you said. I think from what you mentioned again yesterday, like, things are looking up for him, despite the fact that the results were not what you would have liked. And, you know, going into, he had his first start of the year was not very good. It was also only 4 1/3 innings, but he had 6 strikeouts. He had no walks. His first start of the year was solid. It just was very short. It wasn't what you were looking for, but 6 innings, 0 strikeouts, 1 home run allowed, 1 other hit, 1 earned run. It was fine. His, you know, FIP was not great because of the home run, but his XFIP was very good because he wasn't giving up a ton of fly balls or anything like that. Then he had a horrific start against the Yankees. Lasted just 1 1/3, gave up 6 runs, 5 of them earned, had 2 home runs, no strikeouts and 2 walks over that 1 1/3. Like, super ugly. And then he had a start against Colorado where he struck out 4 and walked none in 3 2/3, but gave up 6 runs on 10 hits. No home runs, just got sort of bapped to death in that one. And on top of that, as you mentioned, Gausman started the season, his velocity was down. There were these injury concerns. Things have sort of settled in for him since then. I mean, up until this Minnesota start, he had then gone 4 starts against New York, Kansas City, the Dodgers, and the Nats. Now, the Nats have been better than we expected, but still not a great offense. But Kansas City's been hitting. New York is a good offense. The Dodgers are the Dodgers. Over those 4 starts, 24 innings, 21 strikeouts, 6 walks. It's more walks maybe than you'd want, but not by a ton. Fewer strikeouts than you'd want for sure. But a 0.75 ERA, a 2.70 FIP, a 3.45 XFIP. Things were looking pretty good for a bit there. And then, yeah, yesterday he got beat up by the Twins. I know what you're saying, like, oh, you look at the Twins lineup and it's like, how good is that lineup really? I kind of think we're downplaying the Twins lineup a little bit, just in general. And this is sort of going off on a little bit of a tangent here just for a moment, but that Twins lineup is kind of full of guys that were intriguing fantasy plays before the season, right? I mean, at catcher, you've got Ryan Jeffers, who was statistically like the best offensive catcher in the American League or maybe in baseball last year. He just didn't play a ton. It's not a huge surprise that he can hit. We saw that he could hit last year. Edward Julien, Max Kepler, you know, I've been a big fan of. Carlos Correa having a good season is like a little surprising given how much he struggled lately, but like he's Carlos Correa. We knew this was in his range of outcomes. And yeah, they're getting surprising performance out of Trevor Larnach in a small sample, but like Alex Kirilloff's been worse than we expected. Matt Wallner did nothing before getting sent down. I don't know that I look at this lineup from the Twins and think like, man, they're just killing people this week and I don't understand how they're doing it. Like, it has the potential to be a very good lineup. And so I don't think it's a total shock that they're beating people up. And from that perspective, I'm kind of just like, you know what? We saw some really good things from Gausman yesterday in terms of how things are moving for him. not the results, but the underlying performance. And I think that that matters more. Like, his velocity was the second highest velocity he's had in a start this year. His first one was a little bit higher, but that was a short start. And, you know, but it, like, all that velocity drop stuff he was dealing with, like, things are coming back. Things, like, if you look at this start, actually, relative to last year, this start, and by this start, I don't mean the start against Minnesota. Let's take a step back here. For Gausman, if you look at his start to the season and you look at his velocity charts relative to last year, right now it sort of looks like those three or four low velocity starts, they weren't like some crazy out of the range of normal beat performance for him numbers. They fit in at the low end of what a start looked like for him last year. And his higher velocity starts, like the one yesterday, fit in at where his most of his starts were. So, like, I'm not super worried about Gausman, which means that I think we can sort of expect him. I would buy in on Gausman right now. Like, if I had an opportunity to buy Gausman, I think he'll go back to being the guy we know he is. Imanaga looks special. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, he's striking guys out. He's not walking guys. He's not giving up home runs. And that's the one thing that gets me a little bit anxious with him, is he has a 36.4% ground ball rate. He gets a lot of fly balls. And Wrigley Field is like two different stadiums at different times of year. And as it warms up, I think he may have some issues with the long ball. And if you look at his underlying numbers, like, he's at that 1.08 ERA, which is just stellar. It's a 2.39 FIP, 3.28 XFIP. I think he's going to start to climb towards that XFIP because I think the home runs are going to correct. And I think the league is going to get to understand him a little better. He relies a little bit more on deception than some other guys do, which I think means it takes a little longer for people to adjust. And so I do think he probably climbs back. Like, I think you see that FIP and XFIP go up as he climbs, as the ERA follows it up, if that makes sense. So I think that we're seeing the best of what he's going to bring. And I think there's going to be a step back. I think he is better than I expected him to be, but I do think it's going to be, I mean, it's silly to say he can't continue at this pace. He's not going to have a 1.08 ERA this year. I'm Bold confident take, saying
heard it here first, yeah, on Keeper
Cut. Shota Imanaga going to regress from a 1.08 ERA. I think that his underlying performance, like that 3.28 XFIP, the 3.08 Sierra, like, I think those numbers are also going to regress more towards the mid threes, and the ERA will follow. And so I think I'm still taking Gausman. But I want both of these guys on my roster. Can I have both of them? Is that a choice?
It was during draft season. That was absolutely a choice. I like Imanaga, and I'm not suggesting that he's not going to continue to be good. I would also like to, you know, second Chad's bold statement that he won't be this good, but I think he's going to be good. My concern is, I guess, just one fold, and that the league's going to catch up, right? It always does. He's a guy who's thrown nearly 60% four-seamers. And when you look at his delivery, when he's going from the windup, it's very similar to when he goes from the stretch. And it looks like he's messing a little bit with his timing, which can throw hitters off. And it just, there's no footage on him. He's a professional pitcher who came in, and there was no book on the guy, really. So I'm not terribly surprised at the success that he has had so far, right? I mean, that sounds dumb. Like, obviously, we're all surprised that he's like the front runner for Cy Young right now in the National League, or whatever. Maybe Wheeler is. I don't know. That's not what I'm saying. He's been unbelievable. But, like, it is believable that he could be really good to start his career. And I'm just curious to see how the league catches up. And for that reason, rest of season, I'm with you. I'm going to take Kevin Gausman. Long term, the fact that they're both starting pitchers and one is 3 or 4 years older than the other, that's enough for me to just take Imanaga long term when it comes to this position. But rest of season, I definitely like Kevin Gausman. So when we come back from break, we're going to have to kind of do rapid fire because we've got 6 left and we're already a half hour in. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, folks. Keep or Cut podcast. We are comparing stud surprises to guys who got drafted early and just have not lived up to expectations. This next one we might be able to do pretty quickly because it is catcher, but one of them's a catcher who I know you really liked going into the season. He was getting drafted as a top five catcher. I think he might have been the fourth catcher off the board, and that's Yainer Diaz. And he hasn't really disappointed. I mean, it's not like Yainer Diaz has been bad, but he just hasn't been as good as people drafted him to be so far this season. He is hitting 273 with three homers, 17 RBI, 14 runs. So he's been fine. But I wanted to compare him to Jonah Heim, who for the first half of last year, if people remember, him and Sean Murphy were like unbelievable. And then Jonah Heim had, I want to say it was a hand injury. Can't remember if it was hand, wrist, whatever it was. But it knocked him out for a while. And then he tried to play through it, hurt, when he came back. And it really showed. And obviously he played a toll on his final numbers and ultimately how high he got drafted last season. But it's looking like Jonah Heim is right back where he was. He's hitting 297. The power's coming back. The Rangers obviously have a great lineup. So I think I'd actually rather have Jonah Heim. But I know you were the Yainer Diaz guy, Chad. So what are your thoughts on these two, long-term and short-term?
Yeah, I mean, I like both these guys. I have them both on rosters. I think Diaz, like, it's, yes, he hasn't been sort of what we hoped he would be. If you compare his results to last year, like, he's striking out a lot less. He had a 19.6% strikeout rate last year. It's down to 13.4% this year. That's a pretty big drop from where projections were and everything. His walk rate, which was only 2.9% last year, bit of a free swinger, is up to 4.7% this year. That's still not super high, but it's manageable. It's an acceptable number. He is chasing less. He's swinging in the zone more. He is making contact at a higher rate. So the swing strike rate is down. Like, there's a lot of really positive underlying things with Yainer Diaz. He set a new career max exit velocity. His average exit velocity is up from last year. His hard hit rate is up from last year. His barrel rate's down. And there's a couple of things that I think are dragging down the barrel rate. One is, I think there's noise in barrel rate. I mean, my in general, when I look at a guy and I'm like, their hard hit rate is up, like, they're hitting the ball hard more often, they're hitting line drives more often, things like that. It's like, eh. So their hard hit balls are not falling into the ideal launch angles, but like, that seems like a thing that could correct over time, unless there's something that's changing their launch angle and making them less likely to hit them on the ideal launch angle. And that does seem to be an issue for Diaz. Yainer Diaz, his launch angle is 6.1 this year. It was 11.5 last year. That is leading to a 57.9% ground ball rate for Yainer Diaz. That has to improve. I think the home run per fly ball rate, given how hard he's hitting the ball, will improve. It's 9.4%. It was 21.9 last year. 21.9 is probably too much to expect. 9.4 is probably not enough to expect. Like, it'll be somewhere in between those numbers. But I need to see him putting the ball in the air more. More line drives, more fly balls out of Yainer Diaz. But if he can do that without losing the other gains he's made, he's actually been, like, there's a clear path to him being better than we really anticipated in draft season, given the other improvements that Yainer Diaz has made. Heim, he sort of picked up where he left off, not quite the first half of last year. He's more like where he was, I don't know. He's like somewhere between his overall season numbers and his insane first half last year. And I think it's totally fair to expect him to just sort of keep on keeping on. I don't know. His ex-WOBA is quite a bit lower than his WOBA. But it's like his barrel rate is down from 8% to 6.8%. Like, that's like, I don't know, less than two barrels different. Like, if one ball was slightly harder or slightly different launch angle, his barrel rate would be totally fine. His hard hit rate is fine. The biggest thing that seems to be impacting his ex-WOBA, as far as I can tell, is that his walk rate is down. His walk rate's down because he's chasing a bit more and making a lot more contact outside the zone. I don't know. There's just not a lot there that I'm concerned about. I think he's going to settle in as a very solid offensive catcher this year. I still think I would take Diaz. I think that the upside is higher. I think that he's shown growth and improvement on what we had from him last year that was so good. And I think he can correct the ground ball issues. At least I hope he can. Whereas I think Heim, like, this sort of is what he is. And right now that's better than Diaz. It's not better than what I expect from Diaz. And there is some risk in Heim, given some of the ex-WOBA data, things like that, that you have to be like, can he keep this up? I think he can, but it's not necessarily a sure thing. So give me Diaz.
Yeah, I think long-term I'm taking Diaz. 3 years in age is a pretty big deal to me for catchers. I didn't realize the difference was that much. I think rest of season I'll take Jonah Heim, just because not only is Yainer working through, and you hit the nail on the head with the ground ball rate. I don't know what's going on there, but as long as a catcher is hitting the ball into the ground that much, I really think the ceiling is limited. Obviously, if he finds a way to cut down on it, then the ceiling is going to change dramatically for Yainer Diaz. But until he fixes that, I'm not interested. I also wonder, and there's no way to calculate this, right? But the Astros have obviously disappointed this year, and it's because their pitching has an ERA over 5 right now, which is third worst in all of baseball. If you're in the same sentence as the Marlins and the Rockies in anything, then it's pretty bad. And he's the catcher. Like, how much is that taking a toll on his offensive production? I'm just throwing it out there. There's no way to calculate that. But I imagine it's not a positive influence on his offensive production. So
I do think like, let's forget how their pitching's performing for a moment. Like, let's leave that aside. He wasn't the catcher last year.
Sure.
Right. He was mostly a DH who caught behind with Maldonado as the starter there. Right. So I do think it is, I think it's hard to know, like, oh, is he like mentally distracted by trying to figure out how he can get their pitchers back on track? I don't know. But is it harder to be a catcher than a DH? Yes, it is. Like, that's an easy one to answer. And so I do think it's worth noting for Diaz that, like, he's being asked to do something he hasn't been asked to do before.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, he did make 42 starts at catcher last year and 36 at DH. I'd love to see what the offensive difference was between those games there. I bet it would be pretty interesting. But either way, I think if you have one of these two guys a catcher, you're fine. You're not dropping them. The production's been okay. You're probably fine. So now we have the Cleveland-Boston battle in honor of the Cavaliers and Celtics series, the Battle of the Tanners. One has finally lived up to everything that I wanted from him, and the other has been disappointing, kind of severely disappointing. And that he had like one amazing outing, and that, of course, is Tanner Bibee versus Tanner Houck. Everything seems to be clicking for Houck. I still think the schedule, at least against the offenses that we've faced, has been a little light. But the biggest thing for Houck, it drove me crazy when people say this, like, oh, he just can't go through the order a third time, so he's going to be a reliever forever. I get so sick of that lazy analysis. And he's been good. I mean, he's been effective late in starts. He's gone 7 innings multiple times. He's pitched into the 7th multiple times. Houck has just been strong. Bibee, great season last year. His calling card coming up, though, is supposed to be his command, right? The guy could live in the strike zone. He wasn't going to walk. He was going to stay out of trouble. That just hasn't happened. I'm willing to write off that he's just going through struggles as a young pitcher in his sophomore season. We saw the same thing with Tanner Houck. But Bibee was drafted. He was like a top 100 pick, if I recall correctly. I'm looking that up right now. If he wasn't top 100, it was very close. His ADP was 115. Tanner Houck, you want to talk about a difference in average draft position. His ADP was about 394. So are we already, it's only May 12th. Are we already ready to say that we'll take Tanner Houck over Tanner Bibee the rest of the season? I think long-term I'm taking, I love Tanner Houck, but Bibee's so young, so much more pedigree. I'm fine with, and I trust Cleveland pitching development. I'll take Bibee long-term still. Let me put it that way. I have not seen enough for me to take Bibee or to take Houck over Bibee long-term. But this year, it is getting harder and harder and harder to take Tanner Bibee over Tanner Houck.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is worth noting that, like, you know, the control stuff for Bibee, he had 5 walks in his first start of the year. He had 3 in his third start of the year. Since then, his he's got 9.79 K per nine and 1.69 walk per nine. Those are better numbers than what Houck's putting up. The walk rate is almost the same. It's a little tiny bit higher for Bybee, but he's getting more than a strikeout more per inning or per nine, not per inning. That'd be crazy. More than a strikeout more per nine than Houck. And so there's some underlying performance here that, you know, Bybee had sort of a weird start to the year and then has been back to sort of more what we would have expected. Over that last five start stretch, his FIP is 3.61, his XFIP is 3.40. That's versus a 4.39 ERA, most of which was driven up in his last two starts. And so it's been a weird stretch for him because, like, you know, he was fine against Boston to start that stretch. He was very good against Oakland. And then he was absolutely brilliant in Atlanta. Went into Atlanta, seven innings, nine strikeouts, no walks, no runs, two hits. Like, I know Atlanta hasn't been Atlanta the way we expected them to be so far this year, but goodness, that was a brilliant start. And then he had two, like, pretty unimpressive starts against the Angels and the Tigers. The Tigers one, in his defense, was four runs on five hits, no walks, no home runs. Like, the underlying numbers, five strikeouts in four innings with no walks. Even the five hits over four innings, and none of those are home runs. You don't expect a guy to give up four runs in that situation, right? They just got bunched up, and so things sort of fell apart for him. But, like, he's showing some pretty good stuff. Over that stretch, like I said, a 3.61 FIP for Bybee. He was a 3.52 FIP, 4.22 XFIP last year. Like, I think there's a couple things going on with him. One was, I think the expectations were higher than they should have been because of that sub three ERA. He was never that good a pitcher. And I think he's, other than a rough start this year, sort of pitched to being a mid threes ERA pitcher without the results quite there yet, but with the performance there. And I think that's kind of who he is. And I think that's fine. And I think we should be very happy with that. Which gets us to Houck, who has been better than that. And, you know, I do expect Houck to regress a bit just because, again, it's a little bit like the Imanaga thing. It's not a 1.08 ERA, but 2.24 is not going to continue. But there's room for him to regress and end up in sort of the same spot as Bybee. The difference will be strikeouts. You're going to get an extra strikeout per start from Bybee versus Houck. And that's going to make a difference. And depending on your league structure and how it values things and blah, 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 that'll be the difference. I think if you are less concerned about strikeouts, I could see taking Houck. I think if you need the strikeouts, Bybee is a better bet going forward. But again, this is sort of like the other pitching one. Like, I kind of want both of these guys. I would go after both of them, and I should go trade for some Tanner Bybees is what I should do. That's what my takeaway is here. I should go trade for some Tanner Bybees and hold my Tanner Houck's.
He's definitely a buy low candidate. I'm less enthusiastic about the last two outings. 10 earned runs in nine innings pitched. I mean, like, it's nice that he's kind of figured out the walks. Still worried about if he's cutting down on the walks and going back into the zone and he's getting hit. I don't love that. If your strikeouts per nine, for sure, but he hasn't gone that deep into outings. So they've both pitched eight games, and Tanner Houck has six more strikeouts. The rate isn't as good, but if you are in those rotisserie leagues, your typical 5x5, I think you're going to get more bang for your buck on Houck just because he's probably at this rate. Tanner Houck's not,
yeah,
hasn't been a bastion of going deep into outings for his career, like I touched upon, but so far this year, he's going deep into outings. It's resulting in just higher strikeout volume, and I'm waiting to see Bybee do that. I mean, he pitched seven innings pitched, like you said, in that outlier outing against the Braves. Otherwise, it's been under six innings every single start, including one, two, three, four outings where he didn't even get into the fifth inning. Yeah. Three where he didn't even get into the fifth inning. So, I mean, I still think Bybee has the higher ceiling. I'm just beginning to get concerned about rest of season between these two. I think I'm Houck for 2024. I'm Bybee long term.
Yeah, I think the innings thing is a good point, but I think part of that is he's been getting BABIPed quite a bit, and that's stopped him from getting deeper into games than he should. I think as that corrects, he'll go deeper into games. I do think the last two starts, like, I think the Tigers start was fine. The Angels start is concerning. Like, giving up two home runs to that Angels team, like, that worries me more than you give up five hits and no other base runners in four innings and you end up with four earned runs. Like, that's just bad luck.
And it's worth pointing out, Bobby Wendt pitched seven full innings, two times in August, and then he did it again in September. So it's not like this is a constant thing with him,
yeah.
But so far this year that he has not been able to make it deep into outings. All right, our next one, this one I think will aggravate people, sort of like the Vlad Alec Bohm one, because it's just like, we are a month and a half into the season. Are we really doing this right now? But Jordan Westberg has been unbelievable. Jordan Westberg, the forgotten about, it feels like, Oriole, of all the amazing names that they're calling out, like, what a fun team, just unbelievable, and they still have more coming. It felt like Jordan Westberg kind of got, like, swept under the rug, right? Everything under the hood with this guy looks incredible. He is posting a 9.3% barrel rate, which isn't incredible, but it's better than so many of the players that we've already talked about. The strikeout rate is under 20%. The walk rate isn't amazing, but the exit velocity is almost 93 miles an hour. I mean, Westberg is doing everything. If he wasn't playing in Camden, I mean, I am curious to see the expected home runs. I'm willing to bet it would be a lot higher elsewhere. We don't even need to get into that. Jordan Westberg is hitting the cover off the ball. And this other player, who also plays second base, hasn't been awful. I think he's been like the rest of his Braves lineup, other than Marcell Ozuna, a little disappointing. And that's Ozzie Albies. And I think Ozzie Albies for so long has been viewed as like a power speed threat. The power, despite my criticisms, the power has just simply been there. I mean, at some point you got to accept it. He's hit 24 homers twice and 30 homers twice. Like, that's enough for me, for a guy who's only 27 years old. Like, fine, he somehow hits for power, even though the exit velocities are really never that crazy. Fine. The speed, though, he's stolen 20 bases once. He's done it once. Last year, he stole 13 bags when steals were up across the league. So I don't know how much stock to put into that. And I also think if you look at the last few years, like, I think the batting average floor might be a little bit lower than people might expect. With that said, I love Ozzie Albies. And if you took him, you know, early second round, like he was going, or I'm sorry, probably mid third, if I remember correctly, you're very happy with that. I don't think it's time to abandon ship. But are we ready to start a conversation about Jordan Westberg versus Ozzie Albies, or is it way too early for that conversation? Because I can tell you right now, I'm still taking Albies rest of season. I'm still taking Albies long term. But man, we got to give Jordan Westberg his props.
Yeah, I think I'm going to land in the same place. I'm going to start off by telling you that I know you're like, we talk about this so often, but do you want to guess why Albies is able to hit for so much power despite Statcast data that doesn't quite back it up?
He lifts and pulls. That's right.
Over the last five seasons, there are 275 qualified hitters. He has the 15th highest pull rate. And I will harp on this over and over and over again. Like, I read other people's tweets on this show quite often. I'm going to read my own tweet today if I can find it, because I tweeted something about this recently. There was a tweet that somebody sent out showing pulled fly balls and line drives with an exit velocity over 95 by team. Just the number of fly balls and line drives over 95 miles per hour that teams hit. It got a bunch of attention in Cleveland Twitter because the Guardians are fourth in that stat. They were 29th in it last year. And so I tweeted out, added context, league-wide from 2023 to 2024. So last two, you know, this year plus last year, and why pulled matters, why it's not just hitting the ball in the air hard. The ex-WOBA and WOBA, sorry, let's do it the other way. The WOBA and ex-WOBA on fly balls and line drives 95 miles per hour plus over the last year plus, 787 WOBA, 794 ex-WOBA. Okay, that is obviously incredibly good, right? If you hit the ball in the air, 95 miles per hour plus, good things happen. If you add pulled as a limiter on that and only look at pulled fly balls and line drives, of 95 mile per hour plus. The WOBA goes from 787 to 1,070. And the ex-WOBA goes from 794 to 882. So when you pull the ball in the air, you massively increase your ex-WOBA. Even for the same set of fly balls, right? You massively increase your ex-WOBA and you outperform that ex-WOBA significantly. So that's it. Like that's the Albie story. That's the Jose Ramirez story. It's the Itzhak Paredes story. Like that is why guys are able to do that. So having, again, harped on my favorite topic of pulling the ball in the air. Yeah, I'm still taking Albies, but Westberg's been awesome. I don't know. I mean, let's say this. This isn't just a case. Some of the other cases we've talked about have been guys where it's like the lesser player, the less high drafted player is performing well, but not as well as we expected from the other player, if that makes sense, right? Like Jonah Heim has been good. He has not been as good as we expected Yiner Diaz to be. Westberg's been better than you should have expected from Albies. It's not just that like Albies has been bad and Westberg is better than that, but not as good as like if Westberg keeps doing what he's doing and Albies gets back to being exactly who we expect him to be, Westberg is better right now. He is better than what you should expect from Albies. And so the question becomes, how much do you trust that Westberg will continue to hit like this? And I don't. I think the strikeout rate's going to come up. I think that the power is not quite as legit as it looks. It's a hard thing to point to why, except for his track record. The max EV is not sort of elite. I just generally think what we're seeing right now is not his results outpacing his performance, but his performance is at the absolute peak of what his talent level is. And so I think that'll come down. The results will follow. And so I think I still have to take Albies, but I don't know, man, because I mean, if Westberg has a 377 WOBA, if that drops by 20 points to 357, he's still going to be better than Albies. And not better than Albies has been. I think he's just like that will just be better than what Albies is the rest of the year. So it is closer than you might imagine. But I'm not quite ready to confidently buy in on Westberg.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's bottom line is it's too early. Even if you love Westberg and you were cold on Albies, there's no way you had Westberg over Albies, and I'm just not sure there's been enough of a sample to favor one over the other. I still agree with pulled fly balls. I think I've just been burned by Alex Bregman's power since like 2019, a classic case of that. Jorge Polanco's another one where it's like, if the exit velocity isn't there, I'm worried that the skill is harder to keep up. The skill of pulling and lifting. Now, we've had guys like Arenado and Jose Ramirez make full careers out of it, but those guys also had years of pretty good exit velocities, and I think they're outliers. So I'm not going to knock Albies for the skill that he apparently has of pulling and lifting. I'm just going to always err on the side of those guys with the high exit velocities. We are going to take one more break, and then we're going to do rapid fire last three rounds of this. We have third base, closer, and outfield to go. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Keeper Cut Podcast. We're comparing players here. And Chad, the next one is maybe the smallest ADP difference because Gunnar Henderson was going like, what, third round and Austin Riley was going second. Yeah. But it felt like the third base hierarchy was so cemented the last 2 years where it was Jose Ramirez up top where he should be. Maybe not anymore, but that's where he should have been. And then we had this trio of Rafael Devers, Austin Riley, and Manny Machado. And all three of those to varying degrees have disappointed so far. I think in Machado's case, I don't know if he's necessarily been a streaky hitter, but I just feel okay about Manny Machado. And that's not to say I don't feel okay about Austin Riley as well. But I think if you took Machado over Austin Riley, I think that was a mistake anyway. So I think if Devers and Riley are 2A and 2B, that like Machado is just 3, if that makes sense. Devers has been dealing with a little bit of a shoulder injury. When he's been healthy, he's hit pretty well, but he's not as high on player rankings or player raters because he missed some time on the injured list with a shoulder injury. So I'll cut him some slack. But Austin Riley just hasn't been Austin Riley yet. not exactly worried about him. It's more like, has Gunnar Henderson just become a first round pick? And I oh my God, I don't want to jinx this guy. I'm going to knock on wood. I need him so badly, but he is doing everything, and he is a left-handed hitter, so we don't have to worry about Camden Yards holding back his power or anything like that, or at least not as much as we would about a player like Mountcastle. So has Gunnar Henderson passed Austin Riley? Who are you taking rest of season? Who are you taking long-term?
I think I am going to take Gunnar long-term. Certainly long-term and probably rest of season. I think the other thing with Gunnar that you know, the power breakout, like everyone, like I think he's leading the majors, tied for the majors lead in home runs. Like the power breakout's been discussed. He stole 10 bases last year in 150 games. He's got 6 already this year, right? And he hasn't been caught. And so if he, like right now, he's on like a 30-20 pace, something like that. And yeah, I think everything else looks pretty good. Now, I do think it is worth noting that versus last year, same strikeout rate. Walk rate was 9% last year. It's 8.1 this year. BABIP is 306 last year, 309 this year.
Wow.
And yet his batting average is much higher. His OBP is much higher. The other thing, like if you're not walking more, you're not striking out less, you're not getting a higher BABIP, the other thing that can drive up your batting average on base percentage is home runs. And his home run per fly ball rate is 30% right now. I don't think I am buying a 30% home run per fly ball rate from him. Now, he has a higher hard hit rate and barrel rate than he did last year. So I could see where we could see improvement from him. And it was 19.3% last year. But I think he ends up closer to 20% than 30. I think 20% is probably a good rough estimate the rest of the way. That is going to drag down the home run total. Now, he hit 28 last year. He's still going to hit probably 30 this year. Like he banked the 12 he's got. Like he just has to do what he did last year to get to 30. I think as fewer balls become home runs, I think the OBP and the average will come down a bit, and sort of bring him back to earth a little bit. But I still think, like, you know, you look at what he's projected for, and it's like a 260 to 265 average, a 340 to 345 OBP. Riley projects it like a 275 average and a 345-ish OBPs. Like in average leagues, I think Riley probably ends up with a better average, but not in OBP leagues. He's not going to be better in that category. And you're going to get maybe 12 to 15 steals the rest of the way from Gunnar, given the way he's running right now, versus maybe 2 from Austin Riley the rest of the way. And I don't think it will probably be a legitimate 10 more home runs out of Riley. Right now he has 3, Gunnar has 12. If you told me at the end of the season they have 35 for Riley and 30 for Gunnar, that sounds right-ish. And that's a 32 to 18 difference the rest of the season. I think that's a little extreme. Maybe it's more like 30 to 20 rest of the season, somewhere around there. I still think that I will take Gunner's upside. The possibility that I'm just wrong and that the power continues the way it has, the risk that something's actually wrong with Riley, like all that's enough for me to take Gunnar rest of way.
Love it. Real quick, last point on Gunnar Henderson, because we're in lockstep here. When he first got called up back in 2022 against lefties, he had a 448 OPS, a 130 average. He struck out 7 times in 26 plate appearances, 23 at-bats, whatever. 2023, it really wasn't much better. It was a 617 OPS against lefties. He only hit 209. He had 3 homers in 167 plate appearances, struck out 42 times. This year against lefties, you want to know what the difference is? His OPS against lefties is 1008. His batting average against lefties is 317. He has cracked 4 homers off of lefties. He has struck out 21 times in 60 at-bats. So the strikeout rate is still there, pretty bad against lefties. But when he makes contact, it's been much better. So if he's figured out that half of the game, the sky is the limit for Gunnar Henderson. Let's do 2 closers. One is like the best closer of the last probably 10 years. The other is Mason Miller, who just is like the Terminator this year. So Mason Miller, Josh Hader, I don't really have a whole lot of hot takes. I still think rest of season, if it's just a saves league, if it's not, if it's 5x5, let me put it that way. If it's 5x5, so we're talking saves and not strikeouts per nine, nothing like that, not saves plus holds, not that that really matters here. I think I'd still take Josh Hader, which sounds crazy. Long term, I'm taking Mason Miller.
I would still take Hader this year. I guess it depends how you define long term. I Miller has been brilliant. There's no denying that. We knew he was capable of being brilliant. He still has maxed out at, let's see, 15. Last year he threw 19 and a third innings. Last year that was 19 and third innings in the minors. And then he threw 33 and a third. So 52 and two thirds total innings last year. He's at 16 and a third this year. Like, and that last year he was working as a starter. Like, we haven't seen him be healthy for like two consecutive months. Like, I still think there's a ton of risk that Mason Miller is one pitch away from being out until late 2025. Every day, that's like every pitch he throws, there is the question of like, is this the one? And I'm, so I would still take Hader.
Like that song from The Police. Every pitch you throw, I'll be watching. That's, yeah. I get it. I'm still in denial because I have him literally everywhere. So I'm like, he's just never going to get hurt. He's going to be healthy for the rest of his life.
He might not.
All right. We'll see. This last one I'm excited about. I still love Michael Harris Jr. He was one of the MVPs of spring training. He's just an awesome player, right from AA to the major leagues, and just produced. But Riley Green has been a lot better than him so far this year. And Riley Green was also a much higher rated prospect. Maybe not much, maybe it's a strong word there, but he's 23 years old. So he's right in the same age range as Michael Harris Jr. Michael Harris Jr. is also 23 years old. So I think this is a pretty interesting comparison. There's no way if you drafted Michael Harris Jr. in the second or third round that you're trading him straight up for Riley Green. I understand that. Once again, it is only May 12th. But for whatever reason, some of the criticisms I heard about Riley Green before the season was like, I think the power is limited. I don't know why folks necessarily felt that way. Maybe it was because he plays in Detroit, but like, guys can grow into power. Every time this guy makes contact, he is absolutely smoking the ball. His problem has been strikeouts. He's still striking out a lot, but he's out of nowhere walking at a 15.3% clip, which is in the 96th percentile. So I think his approach at the plate, his discipline is improving, even though it might not necessarily show in the strikeout rate department. He's getting 878 OPS, 9 homers, so he's only 3 behind the major league lead. He hasn't stolen a base yet. And that's going to be, even if Riley Green does start stealing bases again, that's always going to be a plus for the Michael Harris column. He will definitely steal more bases than Riley Green. But are we ready to have a conversation about Riley Green being in the same class as Michael Harris Jr., or is it too early in the season? Who we taking rest of the season? Who we taking long term?
I think we're ready to have that conversation. I'm still taking Harris. To bring this episode sort of full circle, we talked about Vlad earlier. I'm in a dynasty league where this offseason I traded Vlad and a draft pick, a third round draft pick for Harris and Shane Baz. That third round draft pick, just for a little bit of context, turned into Cole Young, Mariner shortstop. So that gives a sense of sort of how I valued that. I still feel really good about that trade. Like, I'm still really happy I have Harris. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, I think, like, you know, his power's down a bit. He isn't having the season we wanted. Well, like, I think he's fine. I think, like, his hard hit rate is fine. The barrel rate's down, but he set a new max EV. His exit velocity is up. I think the barrel rate will follow because he's hitting the ball harder, and that's a good thing. Like, that's my big takeaway on Michael Harris. He's hitting the ball harder. That's a good thing.
Nice.
I, you know, his approach is a little bit off right now. Like he's chasing way too much. He's swinging more than he should in general. I kind of feel like Atlanta as a whole, like they're just in such a funk right now offensively that I wonder if, you know, is he just trying to do a little too much? So I think Harris is going to be fine. And I think at the end of the day, when you compare these two, he has shown more power historically. He is going to steal more bases, and they're both going to get on base at high rates. But I think that Harris is going to strike out less and therefore have higher averages and on base percentages. And maybe on base percentage isn't fair because he won't walk as much as Green. So maybe that's the one thing I really should be putting in Green's column. But if that's the only thing I'm putting in Green's column, I'm still taking Harris.
And I don't even think it's that big of a difference because so far this year it is. But Michael Harris Jr. has posted basically the same OBP the last two seasons. It was right around 338, 339. And that's not bad. And that's right around where Austin Riley would probably be if this walk rate normalized. I don't think he's going to be a 16% walk rate guy for his whole career. Maybe he is. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But if he is, he's going to go into the Hall of Fame. So that'd be quite a leap. So I'm with you, Michael Harris. And that'll do it for today, folks. If you enjoyed this episode, consider giving us a follow at Keep or Cut. You can follow Chad at Chad Young. We're coming out with episodes every Monday. We recorded this episode on Sunday, May 12th, which I think is some important context for whatever happens today. We weren't able to account for it, but we will see you next Monday.